Okay, thank you very much. We said last week when we were looking at it that the versions of what was going on with Hezekiah are a little bit hard to figure out when he gets ill. There's a suggestion here in 2 Chronicles early, before we read it here, that he's become a proud, lifted up sort of figure, and that God is working with him in the midst of this. This is all last week's lesson, really. And it raises some questions for us that we want to take up. But what we have here is a new episode, and I'm looking in verse 31. However, regarding the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, whom they sent to inquire about the wonder that was done in the land, let's just stop there. We have a pen that doesn't work. We have Babylon and some ambassadors who come to visit Hezekiah, and we'll see this again in Isaiah. And they come to do what? No? Do you think that's it? Yeah, there's a sign, a wonder that's happened. Now, we're going to talk about Babylon a little bit at length here, but does anybody off the top of their head get a New Testament connection that would be particularly relevant for us this time of year in Advent? Was Babylon? Yeah, the three kings, the three wise men, the magi. And why did they come? Well, what was it?
A star.
The magi of Babylon were particularly fixated on the stars. They're tremendous astronomers, astrologers, if you will. And they paid a lot of attention to that and put a lot of stock in it. So if they've come to seek out, now remember, we haven't had Babylon in our story yet with Isaiah, but if they've come to look at the sign and wonder, what are we referring to probably here? If they've come to see this in Hezekiah's reign, what sign and wonder? Think last week. Right. Remember Isaiah, or the Lord offered Isaiah or Hezekiah a sign. We want the sun to go forward or backward on the stairway that was actually designed as a sundial, and it wanted to go backward. And I said, great questions about how God pulls off miracles like this. My suggestion is that God can do whatever he wants, whether it appeared to happen within regional context or whether it actually happened astronomically with planets turning. I don't know the answer to that. Doesn't really matter to me. God can do it either way. But my guess is whatever it was, the Babylonians saw it too. Their fixation on the starry realm, perhaps that's exactly what calls them in to see this. Other suggestions are made. There have been other wonders in Hezekiah's reign. In particular, what happened recently? Excuse me? Yeah, he was healed. I don't know that that would bring you ambassadors from Babylon. The fact that he stood down the Assyrian siege, or the start of the Assyrian siege, was big news, I'm sure. Because, remember, Judah's a little player. We've talked about the kingdoms that are here, and think, well, Judah's not particularly important. If they managed to stand down Assyria, then that perhaps was noteworthy too. Although a lot of people say, with the Babylonians coming, they guess something astronomical was going on, and that's why they came to inquire. Now, before we start this lesson that we have today with Hezekiah, let's ask a couple questions. Let's put a few principles up and then see once again how maybe this illustrates it. The first to ask you is, does God test us? Yes. So what's he test you with? What's the capital of Delaware? No. I don't either. Is it Dover? It's Dover. It's one of those ones that's always Springfield and it always messes you up, would it? Is it Missouri? Illinois. It's Springfield. Okay. It's the capital of Montana. Yeah, very good. So you're closer to your elementary school, smarter than a fifth grader kind of stuff there. Is it? So those are the tests that God's raising for us, or what? see what's in our heart. So does everybody think that's true? Okay. This is what's that? Well, that's it. I mean, that would be one question right away. I mean, God doesn't have to run an experiment to find out information because he knows what's there, right? And the Gospels will even say that. Jesus didn't trust himself to others. He knows what's in the heart of a man. So,
but we don't know.
I hear the voice of Rob there. God, I couldn't see you. Yeah, well, we don't know. So what's the outcome of that? Yeah, it's not. I think that's the question. It's not as if God is telling us to jump through hoops. I think it's true to most of our spiritual experience that we have times and situations that test us. They're not exactly, because the Bible's very clear about temptation, that God doesn't tempt anybody. It's not as if God's trying to trip you up. I don't think it's that God's, you know, as I say, telling you to jump through hoops. I think he does allow situations in our life that bring us where, would you say? I mean, what's the test, do you suppose? Okay. It's okay, and you'll actually find scriptural support for the metallurgical image in the book of Peter, right? The testing of your faith, which is more testing than pure gold, which is tried by fire, and those kinds of passages we can look at here in a few minutes. But it is, I think, to give us a clear picture of what's in our own heart. Isn't the idea of the testing situation, it brings us to the end of ourselves in some way, or at least to that somewhat sickening feeling that perhaps we're at the end of ourselves. And what is it that we're at the end of in the testing situation? Okay, our own resources. And in particular, what resources? Oh, there's no end to our pride. We'll never run out of that. Oh, yeah, but what's his test trying to show us then? Okay, that our own resources fall short, whatever they are. But I'm thinking that at the end of all these tests for us is the question, is God there and is he good? That's where our faith begins to flake out, right? He's somehow missing us. He's not seeing me. He's not paying attention. He's not acting on my behalf here. And so you're drawn out into this testing situation in which, yes, your resources are all failing, but they're all causing you to challenge whether, is God really there? Does God really love me? Is he really paying attention to someone like me? Or am I left out here dangling while God, I don't know, does something important somewhere else? Yes, I do. I don't know how to make the most of it in this situation, though. The idea that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me is an important lesson to learn. But I think you have to realize it's Christ strengthening you in those situations. I don't know. In my own situations of trial and test, I really have come to what I think of as that end of whatever the will is in me to continue going for Christ, and found that something was still inside of me. Mentioned it a couple of times in different situations, in church leadership and things like that, where I thought, there's nothing left of me here to put into this. And yet found that somehow or other there was yet a source outside of me that was able to keep me moving. Let's leave that at that, though, for that for now. The question is, does God test us, and are the tests puzzles? Can you flunk the test? I don't think so. I mean, I think God is clearly runs tests to show us what's clearly inside of us for the intention that we will figure out what's really inside of us. How much do we love him? How much faith do we put in him and trust him in situations like that? So that they're not puzzles that we can slip up in that sense, that God's just testing us to see if we're sharp enough or bright enough to solve this Rubik's Cube of questions he's given us. Here's another question for you. How much do you think about your descendants? Do you consider your descendants? I'm just very curious about this, because this ties into the story too. How they'll trickle down into the next few generations. I'm always fascinated by this question. This comes up here, actually, in this story. That's why I'm asking the question. And there's the implication that maybe Hezekiah doesn't regard his descendants very carefully, which is an interesting question. Do you ever wonder if you were somehow dropped into a room with, like, not the people you have living memory of, like great-grandparents or something, maybe you have memories of, but if you went back great-great-great-grandparents, if you were dropped in a living room with them, some parlor somewhere, you know, heaven knows where it'd have to be in my case, you know, somewhere in Scotland or France or someplace, and would I have felt any affinity for these people? Would there be any sense of kinship or bonding with them, or would I have been such a total stranger? Or would there have been a sense of family feeling with them? I did have a very interesting experience in that my mother had a first cousin I never met until about 15 years ago. So he was in my mother's family, but lived in New Orleans of all places, way far away from the rest of her family, and I had no contact with him at all. And it was weird when I got into his house and met him and looked around, I thought, this is weird. It has the family feeling. It the way things were, the everything about it, just thought, it's strange. We're kin. You feel it. You sense it. Am I weird for this?
Well, it's like Rupert, it's like going to my grandmother's house. It's the family built, generations built, that I'll never get to meet again. It's still...
It's haunted. So to speak.
I know. It feels just like a family thing. You're absolutely right.
It's fascinating to me to think about. Well, it all ties into this story. So let's look at a couple different things here, and a little more review first. Remember, we put big players up here early on. Assyria, the big scary country. We had Israel, the northern kingdom. We had Syria, the little less scarier kingdom, and we had Judah. Already in this story, we've seen Assyria has taken down Israel, Assyria has taken down Syria, Assyria has assaulted Judah, but not succeeded in taking it. But Judah's still a small player, and Assyria is still a threat. Remember, we've already gone through several kings. We've had Uzziah, who was the king who became a leper. Pretty good king, really. Pretty fabulous role. We had Ahaz, his son, who was a very bad king, who indulged in human sacrifice, even of his children. And then we have Hezekiah, who's now on the throne and been on the throne for a while. And as you saw in 2 Chronicles, the kingdom has flourished, really. Everything he puts his hand to has prospered. And he has not just gold and silver, but what really attracted me is warehouses full of spices. Why is that so exciting? Well, yeah, but what does that say about a culture? It has time and affluence. So you don't worry about storehousing spices when everything's clamped down. I mean, that's probably one of the first things that's going to go in the budget, right? It's not going to be the highest priority if people just need to eat. It's luxury. It's fabulous kind of thing. And we see that it's prospered under Hezekiah. So we've seen kings go down. We see Hezekiah at the end of a reign that's pretty important for us now. There's another set we've got to talk about now, which is we've got to add a country here. And that is Babylon. It has not been in this story so far, but what's going to happen is that Babylon is going to rise and take over the Assyrian Empire eventually, although not at this time. Babylon's kind of a minor player at this point and not particularly central. Now, if we continue to push the Bible story out, we have another group to figure in there, and that will be Persia. Now, the interesting things that are going to be said about this is that Judah, although it withstands the assault of Assyria, will, about 130 years later, be taken down by Babylon. And that will be the time period of the other great prophets. That'll be the time period of Jeremiah and a little later Ezekiel. That will tell the story of what happens when the Babylon takes over Assyria and then runs over Judah and takes the people into captivity in Babylon for 70-some years. And they will come back in about three waves and rebuild the kingdom and all that business. They will do that only under the Persians, because the Persians will take over Babylon. So, that gets complicated, doesn't it? Babylon takes over Assyria, Persia takes over Babylon, and eventually the kingdom will start again. They'll come back to Judah. This will be the time period of, Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel brings the first group back under that. But Babylon's a player now that comes in. It won't happen for another 100 years or so that any of this is going to start to unfold, except who has come to visit Hezekiah? Babylonians, of all things. And there's, as I say, minor players, but they have come to investigate the miracle. And Hezekiah likes the fact that they've visited him. He finds them convenient people, and he shows them around and wines and dines them a little bit, so to speak, when they get there. So, let's read Isaiah 39. It's a short little chapter. We can read it in two installments. When you get to Isaiah chapter 39, would somebody read us the first four verses? Makes me want to visit your house tomorrow night, Steve, and just poke around the closets and things. Guy's secretive. Did it? Well, you'd take them around. I don't know if you'd open every closet. On the other hand, Babylon will, within 100 years or so, rise up against Assyria. It could be they're feeling out Judah. Hey, if you've stood down the Assyrians, perhaps you're a useful ally to us. Perhaps we can talk business, so to speak. You know, it wants to. There could be all kinds of motives here. Remember, their fascination with the astronomical mirror. Miracle isn't mentioned here, but that seems to be a big thing that's driving them. I've heard Hezekiah has been sick. They've sent him, get well. No, about this miracle, will you tell us about it? But I don't know. What are you with Steve on this?
I'm with Steve 100%. In fact, I wonder if they were even truly magi or wise men. They might have been spies all along.
Oh, these guys aren't necessarily magi. Well, that's true. Yeah, were they
astronomers? That's what they were there.
I'm wondering what you guys think, you guys who don't like this, they're these... There's this, is it radio telescopy? They're sending messages out into space in all kinds of digital languages and foreign languages, broadcasting out into space. Hi, we're here on Earth. Welcome. We mean only peace. Take us to your leader kind of stuff. And they're broadcasting it out into outer space. Do you like that idea, Steve?
Sure.
Do you? There's like one. There was like one congressman from who knows where, you know, Idaho or somewhere. I don't know if he's like the tinfoil hat kind of guy or not, but he just thinks this is like abominable to be telling all the aliens where you are. you don't want them to read these signals because heaven only knows what they'll do if they catch them. Good eats at Earth, see at five, you know, something like that. Well, what do you think? Well, I'm still looking for reactions to Hezekiah's touring of the Babylonians. Yeah, like, here's the nutmeg closet, you know. Well, I'm just curious about this because a lot of commentators are very, Bible commentaries, you know, academics and even pastors and popular commentators are very hard on Hezekiah about doing this. And I often have read it and thought, well, was he an idiot, you know, or arrogant, or what was going on with his touring of the Babylonians. Now, as I said, 100 years or so from then, they will take over Assyria. They will come and bring Judah down. They will take the Jews into exile in Babylon. I mean, that's all going to happen, but it is way down the road, right? I mean, 100 years from now, what are you thinking about 100 years from now? Possibly. Why don't we read the rest of the chapter? Would somebody read us 5 through 8? All right. So Isaiah, who has access as a prophet, unique to the king's ear, what'd you show him? I showed him everything. I didn't hold anything back. And he says, "Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all you've accumulated will be carried to Babylon." And what's worse than even that? Even your own descendants will eunuchs. Now, without going into painful detail about eunuchs or eunuchdom, what's one thing that can be said for certain of eunuchs? Right. That the family tree kind of comes to an abrupt stop, whatever the eunuch line is, right? Why did they have eunuchs back then, by the way? That helped. What was their role there, of course? They were... Well, right, you could put a eunuch... This wasn't the principal role of the eunuch, but you would put a eunuch in charge of the harem because, of course, they weren't sexually functional, you know, so they're no threat to the king's wives, or at least in most cases. So that would be one issue. But that wasn't really why you had eunuchs. Precisely. They could be trusted to be in high and powerful positions, but not establish any kind of competitive line for kings, and so the eunuchs were actually often powerful people, but with no descendants. So that they served. They had no family interests. Also, they had no family interests to look out for or try to aggrandize. They could be identified and completely with this. It has been suggested, and it's hard to say, that Daniel might have been a eunuch. It's not said explicitly. Lots of people assume it to be true. I never knew what to think of that one. And biblically, I thought, well, that would be... You don't hear about Daniel's descendants, certainly. And he would have played that role high up in the authority of Persia. Remember, way down the line when Persia takes over Babylon. Interesting thing to say about eunuchs. But Hezekiah's attitude on all this is... Well, peace in my time. Look, the Assyrians escaped me. Look what the Assyrians do to people. I can't be responsible for what happens 100 years from now. For heaven's sakes, you know, if they have to deal with things that I've been a part of, I can't really change anything down the line. It's beyond me. It's beyond my reach. But I know that I will finish my own race well enough in peace. Well, once again, people can be really hard on Hezekiah, and I've never had that feeling when I first read it, like, oh, you idiot. But I don't. I'm in the minority. Every once in a while, you'll pick up a commentary and say, well, Hezekiah wasn't that dumb, but most people say, yes, he was. I'm just curious.
I don't know that he was dumb.
Well, that's why I asked that question. How much do we consider our descendants? I mean, how much is that really on our mind when we do things? How far down the generations do we look? You think, well, maybe someday I'll have grandkids, but what do I think about those people I won't know at all? Is it too much of an abstraction to really think about? And I think, well, I sure hope I keep that in mind. I just refer us back, though, to 2 Chronicles, where we started with this. Ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, whom they sent to inquire about the wonder that was done in the land, God withdrew from him in order to test him, that he might know all that was in his heart. Not that God would know, but that Hezekiah would know all was in his heart, and we don't really know the outcome of if there's any change here. What else to say about this? Let's jump ahead a little bit in the sense of, or consider it, what will happen is everything's going to be taken off to Babylon. And we've seen two captivities, really. Or we see two of these issues going on here. The northern kingdom gets taken off, the northern kingdom of Israel, 10 tribes, gets yanked off into, of course, into Assyrian territory, and they never come back. That part of Israel and Jewish history comes to an end. It's over. They don't return. What happens is that some people will be resettled in the land. There'll be kind of a mixed race. Eventually, this will become Samaria, and it will have retain some startling connections with the Jewish faith. But you know the whole story from the New Testament. The Samaritans are an interesting intermediary group of people between Jews and Gentiles. That's the Assyrian captivity, and that happens in the north. This happens in Hezekiah's lifetime. The captivity of Judah, the southern kingdom, Jerusalem into Babylon, is not going to happen for, I forget what I've added, it's like it's 130 years or something like that, that they'll be taken off into Babylon. It will last 70-some years, and then they will return to Israel. They come back in three waves, actually. As I said, Zerubbabel the king, that great name, I had a friend who named her dog that. Zerubbabel the king brings the first group back. Then about 70 years later, you get some other people involved in the return to the kingdom. Let's see if I wrote it down anywhere. Yeah, Zerubbabel will bring them back. Then it's almost 80 years later that you'll get Ezra and Nehemiah coming back to kind of get that movement of a return to Judah back, and it'll roll that way. But the question is, this is captivity that never ends, in a sense. It ends. This is a captivity that ends, and it's sometimes called the exile. Why does it happen? I mean, Isaiah has said there's going to come a time when everything you've shown them is going to end up in Babylon, and some of your own descendants will be eunuchs. But why does that happen in either case, or in both cases, is it the same? Okay. Is it punishment? Is it a test?
Judgment?
Yeah. Well, it is judgment, certainly. But once again, I keep thinking, why does God judge? Well, that's it. I keep thinking there's this testing idea that why does God do what he does? And it seems that he has redemptive and loving purpose in everything that he does. That never escapes him, so that if it's punishment, it is punishment in love. Is it testing? To show people what they're made out of. But why does it happen? That's the question. What are the sins that are so grim that caused this first to take down the Israelites to the Assyrian, and then later after Hezekiah's death? You get like four or five kings in here that are, we don't have to study at this point. But as I said, you'll end up about the time of Jeremiah when the kingdom goes down. So if we were to jump and study the prophet Jeremiah, we would see the collapse of this southern kingdom. And Jeremiah, of course, the weeping prophet, all he can do is denounce. If you want to just hold on a little bit later, then you read Ezekiel, who's actually a prophet in exile, right? And so the three biggie prophets of the Old Testament map out this story for us. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you get that Mount Ebal and Mount Nebo, is it? Or what are the two mountains?
So idolatry.
Well, that's... If you take these issues apart, it seems like at the foundation of problems in both places, the thing that brings them down, the thing that requires something so drastic that God seems to have to destroy in order to build anything new up of good religion in its place, it seems that at the very heart of it is always the claim that they feared other gods. The idea that they shared religious devotion with other deities, That's the place where it all goes awry. So if you study it in 2 Kings, for example, over Israel, they give a big list in 2 Kings as to what they did. It's they feared other gods. They walked in the statutes of other nations and their other gods. They did things in secret that were not right. They had high places with sacred pillars and wooden images. These would all be images of idolatry. They burned incenses to these gods, and they even performed human sacrifices, and they resorted to witchcraft and soothsaying. That would be the indictment against this group as it goes down. And the indictment against Judah is pretty much the same thing. They are people who fear other gods. They are people who practice idolatry, and then particularly when you get into Jeremiah, you'll see that that's resulted in some other things. In particular, you get big justice issues there. It's said of Judah, "You have filled Jerusalem with innocent blood." They're not caring for people who need your care. Not dispensing justice. And so there's a lot of that going on see if I can find you a passage. By the time idolatry has borne its fruit, it's resulted in just terrible injustice. I'm looking for a passage here to read you that summarizes that for us. I'm reading from Jeremiah 2:13. This is the indictment. "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken the fountains of living water and hewn for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water," would be one of the passages that's an indictment of theirs. Jeremiah 22, that will bring down the kingdom. Jeremiah 22, I keep losing my reference here because of my poor handwriting. I'm sorry. There it is. 16 and 17. Then he judged the cause of the poor and needy, then it was well. "Was not this knowing me, says the Lord? Yet your eyes and your heart are nothing but your covetousness, for shedding innocent blood and practicing oppression and violence." These would have been God's indictments of what happens in Judah, that he brings them down. And it all seems to start with idolatry and false pictures of God. So think about that for a moment. How does that work? Yeah, that's what I was asking, Cleve. Can you blame it on the kings? Do the kings reflect their time or fail to lead the people away from their natural or broader inclinations? And that's where kings come under special indictments morally, but in fact all they are is a reflection of the times they live in. The issue is they're supposed to be more than a reflection of the times. They're supposed to hold the line and lead you towards good things, not merely reflect the morality of the age around them. But in fact, most leaders do just reflect their times. It's an age-old question, right? Do people put forth the leaders that please them? I mean, kings, that's a little complicated with the genetical stuff that goes on there and things. But what do you think about this? False gods and the worship of false gods seems to be the start of it all. It leads to all kinds of perversion, right? Because the foundations of ethics and morality are founded in certain religious ideas. So if you have a god that'll call for human sacrifice or have some sort of, in the case of the high places and the wooden poles, even cause for worship that's part of the practice of sexual immorality, you see how that, or then turns a blind eye to the tremendous injustices or violences that are there. As a religion sort of gives you a pretext and a justification for doing things that are more and more wicked, and saying, "And I'm fine with the gods because they're the ones who sanction this, and you're missing all the morality there." And that's where the slippery slope starts with the false god, the tolerance of the idols. The question is, we're not tempted towards idols, but what does the lesson tell us? I mean, I don't think many of you are tempted towards the worship of idols per se. But aren't we tempted towards false pictures of God that could lead us out into to positions that become increasingly perverse? Because it's really easy to lie to ourselves about who God is, the nature of God, and what he expects of us, right? It's very easy to create pictures that respond to the worst in us and then apply them. And so I think, well, yeah, it still happens. We can understand. We're made of the same human stuff that they were made of back then. They weren't particularly perverse or worse than we were. And their kings can't necessarily be blamed for corrupting them. They're responding to the same inner stuff that's in us. And I think that bears a great lesson to us, to make sure our picture of who God is clear. And that will lead to better things. Yeah. Oh, I think certainly we can. Well, I think, you know, I think some of the, let me say, the flag waving stuff is a perversion that happens. We have a tremendous wealth that we don't seem to distribute as Christians. We see it rather as God's blessing us rather than becoming a blessing. I think there's our picture of God as our the person who just blesses us because we're so wonderful, that doesn't really spread out to any justice, good works, those kinds of things. I'd say, well, that's perverse. I don't think God's probably very pleased with that. And that certainly happens. You see it around the church a lot. Well, that's why I think that the answer to this is to stay very close to the Bible. That our tendency to craft idols is enormous. We're very creative at declaring what God is like and what he should be like morally. But what is there any objective way of restraining that impulse in ourselves? I think stay close to the Bible. Stay very close to the Bible and check all pronouncements about God's character against the Bible. Well, let's just finish with this idea of God testing us to show us what's really in our heart, not as puzzles, but to show us what we're really made of for our own benefit, so that we can see that at the end of ourselves we call to God. Let me get a few passages of scriptures read, and we'll just finish on those. Let's see. Would somebody read us James chapter 1, verse 3? Very good. So the testing of our faith can produce endurance in us. How about 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4? God who tests our hearts, to please God rather than men. And it's always the problem of perversity in religion is that it seeks to please people rather than God. And that's a constant tendency to work a bit. And then we can go back to what Molly brought up at the very beginning of the metallurgical image. Let's go to 1 Peter and finish with that one. 1 Peter 1, 7. Yeah, very good. And your word refined there is the same word that's been in all of these passages. It can be translated tested. And it's sort of another take on that view. So I'll leave it at that. I don't know what you think of Hezekiah and how God abandoned him to test him was hard or how he came out of it. But the question is, does God test us? I'd say the New Testament passages certainly are clear that he does test us, and it's not to create puzzles for us to figure out or hoops for us to jump through, but to see what really is going on inside of us. Anybody want a last word?